for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama meets with Central American leaders about the child migrant crisis. Federal courts issue contradictory rulings on Affordable Care Act subsidies. And a botched execution in Arizona renews debate over lethal injections. Joining me for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Manu Raju of Politico, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and Chris Freitz of CNN. And since it's Friday, you can watch a live video stream of this program on our website, drshow.org. You can call us on 800-433-8850. If you'd like to be part of the program, send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to all of you.
It's good to be here.
Great to be here.
Nice to see you all. Karen Tumulty, when President Obama meets with these three leaders to talk about the child migrants, what can he get from them? What can he do on his own?
Well, I think there are two big issues right now on the table. One is money. The White House, the administration, has requested close to $4 billion to deal with this problem. The Senate has authorized working on maybe two-thirds of that much, and the House is talking about one-third that much. The other question is whether they are going to rewrite the 2008 law that was signed by President Bush in his final days in office that essentially allows immigrants from countries that are not contiguous to the United States, not Mexico, not Canada, to receive a different kind of due process for their asylum requests. And the Republicans, and I think even a lot of Democrats, and the White House itself a few weeks ago was saying that this law, that the administration does need to have, if not changes in the law, some flexibility in how it administers it.
Yeah, and the House and the Senate are definitely on a collision course here when there are two different packages to deal with this problem along the border. Not just, as Karen mentioned, the fact that they are far apart on funding, with the House at $1.5 billion and the Senate at $2.7 billion. But the 2008 law is really the flashpoint between the House and the Senate. A lot of Democrats in the Senate are very concerned that if you change this law, it's going to make it much harder for child migrants to seek asylum in this country, people who are fleeing violence in places like the Honduras, where street gangs are threatening the way of life for millions of people in those regions. The question is, what do you do now? And the Senate Democrats don't want to touch that law. They think the president has the executive authority to deal with deportation cases and move them more quickly through the proceedings, and Congress does not need to act. But the Republicans say there needs to be some change, some policy change. Otherwise, we're just throwing money at a problem that's going to continue to fester.
But, Chris, can't the president on his own allow those migrants to stay here, to issue an executive order to allow them to stay?
And that's exactly the Democrats in the Senate's argument here, is that we want to allow the president to use the existing law to make those changes. We don't need to make those changes. But the overarching argument here, particularly from House Republicans, is they need some kind of policy change to convince a lot of the conservatives who don't want to do anything. I mean, many of the conservatives in the House don't want to move on any kind of immigration bill, and they say it's the president's mess, let him fix it himself, we shouldn't help him at all. That's the conservative wing. House leadership is saying, well, no, we need to do something. They're particularly afraid that if they don't do anything and we come up on August recess, where there's a month here where the president has the bully pulpit, the president can control the message about the obstructionist House, how they don't want to solve our problems, and that could hurt them going into the election year. Because remember, House Republicans didn't want to deal with immigration immigration at all. I mean, they didn't take it up. They didn't take up a piecemeal package like they promised they would after the Senate passed its comprehensive bill last year. This is an issue that's anathema to most of House Republicans. They don't want to deal with it.
So, meanwhile, what has Governor Rick Perry done?
Well, he has taken 1,000 National Guard troops to the border. And what's interesting about that is it's mostly a symbolic move by Perry. These National Guard troops aren't going to be arresting people coming over the border. They're simply going to be referring and deterring, as they said, which is, you know, deterring. They're trying to deter folks from coming over by amassing these National Guard troops. And they're referring them, once they do come over, to Border Patrol, where they'll be taking and processed.
You know, I was really struck, though, at Rick Perry's announcement the other day because he almost didn't mention the child migrants at all. He portrayed this as a move to deal with drug trafficking, and he talked about the, you know, 700,000 crimes that have been committed since 2008 in Texas by the illegal immigrants. You know, it was sort of, he was talking about a completely different problem than the one that everyone else is talking about this summer, which was, not only was that striking, but I also talked to some senior Republican legislators in Texas, and they are not happy about this because Rick Perry and Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, they are leaving office. So essentially, they are calling up the National Guard, and they are going to be leaving it to the legislature to figure out how to pay for this. They're not going to even be around when the bill comes to us.
Yeah, and I think it's the 2016 politics of this is very interesting as well. I mean, Rick Perry is considering another run for president. And remember, when he ran in 2012, he ran as almost a moderate on immigration. There was an in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants that he was supportive of in that state. So he was running to the left of Mitt Romney, and he made that infamous remark that he said, you know, to the critics of that proposal, it says, well, I don't think you have a heart. And the conservatives really latched onto that. That really hurt his presidential hopes at that time. And now he's taking a much firmer line on this issue. And it shows that if he does run again, which it looks like that he will, he's going to try to use this, show himself as an immigration hardliner at a time when the Republican base is in line with that.
But meanwhile, don't you have many of these children showing up in various states, Virginia, Maryland, for example, Chris?
Well, absolutely, and it's become a problem for many state governors because in Maryland it was an issue, in Virginia it was an issue, and that's something that the states are having to take control over, and Perry's trying to display some power here and say, look, I am taking a proactive approach at my border, and I'm trying to make sure that these children don't come across, and it's a harder line. But I think it plays well in a place like Iowa, but it doesn't really solve the problem. And to Karen's point, it's $12 million a month to deploy National Guard on the Texas border. There's no plan for that. I mean, so you could also see in a presidential debate situation where people say, well, where's the fiscal conservatism there?
So how are these states where these young kids are being transported, how are they reacting?
In totally different ways everywhere you look. And mind you, too, when you talk about law enforcement, these kids are turning themselves in. So this is not a situation of arresting them. They come across the border and turn themselves in. At that point, they become either, you know, the responsibility of charitable groups. The federal government has informed the governors that they may be sending some of them to federal facilities. But it was really interesting. Last week, I was in Iowa with Chris Christie, and Terry Branstad, the governor of Iowa, has said, absolutely no, we are not bringing them to Iowa because, you know, they're breaking the law, and we don't want to encourage more people in Central America to put their kids on this dangerous journey. And Chris Christie said, you know, I agree that this is a horrible thing, but I think we need to look at this on a case-by-case basis. Mm. So I think the different states are going to end up in very, very different places
and
on this.
Some of these children really have parents here already.
Yeah, that's been the real heartbreaking thing about this, because folks are trying to get their kids and reunite them with their families, which is why the concern over changing this 2008 law, because what that law allows kids to do from those non-contiguous countries is to seek in front of an immigration judge and have their day heard in court. And the concern is if you change that law, these kids who want to reunite with their parents may not be able to do just that.
And just to piggyback on what Manu was saying, remember that law passed unanimously back in 2008, and it was largely targeted at many of these children were coming across, and they were victims of sex trafficking and sex crimes. So it was an opportunity to let them air their case about why they fled the country that they came from, and to have a full hearing on that. And so there's some concern that if you shorten that, then these kids won't be heard and they'll be thrown back into a dangerous situation.
But, you know, Karen, you mentioned Iowa. I heard some residents of Iowa say, we've got enough room here. We can take these kids in.
Yes, and the governor, Branstad, has come under a lot of criticism for his kind of hardline stance. But then at the same time, you have cities and towns all over the country in places like Texas and elsewhere that are passing local ordinances to preemptively announce that they don't want to, you know, take kids in their city. There was a rumor going around in South Carolina that some of them were coming there. So Governor Nikki Haley made a big point of calling up the Department of Homeland Security. And so it's complicated.
Karen Tumulty, The Washington Post. We'll talk about the domestic fallout on this immigration policy. And remember, you can see all of our guests on our live video stream, drshow.org. And back to the issue on child migrants in the Friday News Roundup. A tweet from Anne. Please explain the reason for distinguishing between contiguous and non-contiguous countries in the 2008 immigration bill in the first place.
And that was the child sex trafficking I was talking about a little bit earlier. The idea was that if you are coming so much further to flee, then you might be fleeing something. They had trouble with sex trafficking, and they wanted to give people who were fleeing into the United States the ability to make that case. And that was going to be different than, you know, people who could come across the border more easily in Mexico or Canada.
And the tweet from Lindsay, where is the line between the children as migrants and calling them refugees? What's the difference?
There is a very specific legal definition of what a refugee is. And a refugee is somebody who is being persecuted in their country because of who they are, because of their race, because of their religion, because of a political position that they take. And it is far from clear whether these kids who are fleeing kind of generalized violence would qualify under the legal definition of what a refugee is. You know, a lot of people argue that the most complicated and yet longest, most important solution to all this is making these countries more sane and safe places, which is something that we did in cooperation with Colombia back in the 1990s when some of these same conditions were prevailing. But again, that's the thing that nobody's talking about.
Costs money.
It costs a lot.
Yeah, and that the administration is weighing exactly how to deal with each of these Central American countries. The Honduras, for instance, is something that they're considering giving refugee status for those kids who are fleeing, given the street gangs in that country. So we'll see exactly how the administration deals with it. It's probably one of the issues that will come up when the president meets with the leaders of the Central American countries.
Manu, what's the fallout for the president from all of these foreign policy crises?
You know, it's going to hurt his approval rating, I'm sure, because when the public sees the constant effort to respond to crises internationally and at the Southwest border, typically these things take a hit on the presidential standing. You know, that's been kind of the frustration with the president throughout his second term. He's had to respond to one crisis, one international incident after another, really has not been able to push any sort of domestic agenda at a time when Congress is gridlocked and when he's had to kind of keep, you know, moving on the flying by the seat of his pants to deal with these various issues. Right now, the president's approval rating is at 43%. And when you look at the historically in the Gallup polling, it says that when a president is under 50%, typically he loses on average 36 seats in the House in that midterm election season. So if these incidents keep happening, the president grows less and less popular, it's going to hurt him in the midterms come November.
And in the meantime, more criticism because he's out at fundraisers, Chris.
Well, that's right, Diane. And I think the way that the White House looks at this is that, you know, they have always been pretty reticent to allow anything to knock the president off his schedule, whether it's world events, whether it's fundraising. And, you know, their explanation to that was, you know, sometimes it's not good to run back to the White House when there's a crisis. They did everything they could to show that he was dealing with it. He was making calls to foreign leaders on Air Force One. He went into the den of one of the homes where he was holding a fundraiser to hold a secure conference call with his national security leaders. The White House let everybody know that the president's still working on the road. And part of that reason, Diane, is that one of the only things the president can do right now for Democrats is raise money. He can raise millions of dollars at one of these fundraisers. In fact, there was a story in the Washington Post today about the Democratic National Committee. The president has done 18 fundraisers for them and knocked their debt down 80% since February.
Wow.
So he's raising millions of dollars at a time. Now, of course, Republicans are going to criticize him, but vulnerable Senate Democrats in particular don't want to be seen campaigning with him. So this is kind of one of the few ways he can help.
But I think the real question that the president is up against here is whether he was asleep at the switch on this. Because now the White House argues, well, for instance, the situation in the border didn't become a crisis until May. That is not what charitable groups say. That is not what members of Congress say. That is what – there's a lot of evidence that this problem has been building for quite a while, that the administration did not do anything about it, in part – and again, the Washington Post had a big story on Sunday, in part – a number of people said because they were afraid it would jeopardize the overall cause of immigration reform. And now, you know, they are paying for it. And it's the same kind of critique that has been lodged against this administration for not seeing ISIS coming in Iraq. And, you know, again, a number of other areas, it's really their competence that's being called into question.
Yeah, and that's what's the problem with this border package right now. I mean, the president just proposed this $3.7 billion package when people in Congress were calling for a supplemental funding bill as early as the spring. So this is something that's been hanging out there for a while. The administration acted late, and now we're in the thick of an election season where even moderate Democrats, people who are up in these tough red states in the Senate, don't want to take a tough vote that can be used against them. And the House Republicans have little incentive to compromise when they see their chances of winning the more seats in the House and taking back the Senate, too. So the president and the White House are taking a lot of criticism for not acting much more quickly on this.
And real quickly, they are maybe one event away from a Katrina moment, right? You remember President Bush was on a West Coast swing for 2 days before the storm hit. It was approaching. He didn't change his schedule. That looked like a terrible mistake in 2020. If that happens to this White House now, and there's one more thing where the president's out and about, he's on vacation, he's fundraising, it's going to look very bad for him because of everything that's come before.
And one more area where there is certainly a lack of compromise, the Affordable Care Act, where two appeals court rulings totally contradictory.
Yeah, but it was really a wild day on Tuesday. You really don't see two appeals courts rule on the same exact issue within hours of each other and then go the opposite directions. And an issue as big as this, like Obamacare, but they did. And it really has to do with the idea of whether or not the law intended to give subsidized coverage through the federal health care exchange. Now, there are about 36 states right now that have refused to implement their own state-based exchanges, these marketplaces where people can buy their insurance online. And so the federal government has come in and imposed this, the federal exchange. The question is whether or not the legislation was, the debate in the courts right now is whether or not the Congress, you know, you can look at the congressional intent or the actual straight reading of the legislative text. And when you look at the straight reading of the legislative text, it says that it suggests that only states, people who do sign up through the states can get this subsidized coverage. But congressional intent suggests something different, and that's the way that the Virginia appeals court went. So now the question will be whether or not what happens on appeal. The administration is appealing the D.C. Circuit ruling, and if the D.C. Circuit ruling, the full panel in the D.C. Circuit sticks with the three-judge panel, then this could go to the Supreme Court, and this could really strike at the heart of the law.
Is that what you expect to happen?
I expect that will happen. I expect that with two separate rulings, the whole panel will have to take it up. And I think there's a very good chance this ends up the Supreme Court. And the thing to remember about this, Diane, is the reason that it only says states is because during this healthcare debate, which I covered intensely, they were jammed at the end. They didn't have the votes. Remember, this passed with only Democratic votes. And so they didn't have the ability to go back and make some of these technical changes, to clean things up, to make sure that the language
Karen's
was tight.
Karen's laughing.
I was just thinking of a tweet that Michael Shearer of Time magazine sent out as these rulings were coming down. He tweeted, "Just kids, this is a reminder. Check your work before you turn it in."
Absolutely. And I think part of what the Obama administration underestimated was the court challenges that would come. And they said, well, things have always been challenged. Social Security was challenged. Medicare was challenged.
Yeah, but there's a question here as to whether that was deliberately written ambiguously.
I don't think so. I think it was sloppy draftsmanship. And it was also they were operating on the assumption at that point that the states would set up their own exchanges. They were giving them a lot of money to do it. They were giving them a lot of guidance. The assumption was every state would want to do it their own way. Well, they just totally underestimated.
Okay. So what does this mean both short-term, long-term for the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the government says that folks who want to get subsidies still can get subsidies, so it does not affect anything right now. The long-term implications are unclear because, you know, by 2016, it's estimated that about 7.3 million people will be getting some sort of subsidized health care coverage. I mean, that's about 62% of the enrolled population by that time. And, you know, we're talking about $36 billion in subsidies that would be going out to these millions of folks. So if people cannot get the subsidies through those 36 states who have refused to enact their state-based exchanges, some of these families may decide, why should I continue with my health care coverage? Does it make sense for me financially? I should just take the hit take the penalty that's imposed on me every year, because that's going to be less costly for me and my family. And if they make that decision, that can really strike at the goal of the law, which is to expand affordable health care coverage across the country.
It really does cut at the individual mandate, this idea that everybody has to carry coverage. And if people look at the penalty and say, mm-hmm. I'll pay a penalty because it's less than what I'll have to pay for an unsubsidized premium, the market may collapse. And just to give you an idea, Diane, the White House says that the subsidies are reducing premiums on average from $346 a month to about $82 a month.
Right.
So that's a huge
right.
amount for a family.
Right.
And you can see why they would choose to say, well, I'm just not going to get coverage if it's going to cost me $350 a month.
Well, but here's where Republicans are on kind of tricky ground, aren't they? They're praising the D.C. Appeals Court ruling, but aren't they out to save money as well?
You know, this has been the kind of contradiction the whole way through. I mean, all of these states that have turned down the Medicaid money to expand their Medicaid programs. It was essentially a gift from the federal government. It was certainly something their hospitals wanted to see, because they treat a lot of people now for free. And it's just that the opposition to this law, particularly in conservative states, and the mistrust of the law, and it just the, you know, ideological opposition to the law is still so strong. And no one would have predicted, I think, that this would still be raging like this.
Karen Tumulty, The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Karen, the House recently passed a highway funding bill. So where do we stand now?
Yeah, hot diggies.
Hot diggies.
Congress passes legislation, unfortunately.
Short-term fix.
Yes. At this point, the Highway Trust Fund is going to start running out of money within a month. So, and there really is not much of a sign that the House bill... The Senate has a proposal to increase the gasoline taxes, which fund the Highway Trust Fund. This is something that has not been done since the early 1990s. And the House bill, it's a temporary extension. They would transfer $10.9 billion from elsewhere. There is no sign of an agreement. And so there is a real question of whether we're going to see a lot of infrastructure spending slowing down in August. We're talking about 700,000 jobs tied to this kind of spending. And again, it is once again the story of Washington, in this case, writ small. It's just, you know, they cannot agree on anything.
No time.
Yeah, the Senate will accept this $10.9 billion short-term fix. You know, it is a short-term fix. It'll only go through next May. But this has been, ever since 2008, Congress has constantly punted on how to deal with or overhaul the Highway Trust Fund. This is an issue that is a big problem because the needs of states are growing, they're going more expensive, and people are driving more fuel-efficient cars. So the gasoline tax is not as valuable as it once was. There's a yawning gap about how much revenue is coming in and how much is going out. So you add to that the steadfast opposition of Republicans to raising taxes at any cost, that it makes it very difficult to get a deal on exactly how to replenish this trust fund. And so when we come back next May, they're going to have to deal with this issue again.
Suppose another bridge collapses in the midst of all this, Chris.
You know, Diane, I'm not confident that that would even get this Congress to act, because we saw that happen and they still didn't pass a 5-year plan. I mean, that's kind of a minimum to be able to plan these big highway projects, to redo bridges, to resurface roads. And we still didn't see that. And just to give you an idea, last year, $37 billion was taken into the Highway Trust Fund and $50 billion was spent. So that's a $13 billion deficit just last year, because the needs are so great. The gas tax hasn't been increased since 1993.
Right.
So as Manu pointed out, you have more fuel efficient vehicles using less gas. And when you adjust for inflation, it's pennies on the dollar for what we used to get in terms of revenue. So you either need to come up with, you either bite the bullet and raise the taxes, or you need to come up with a new way to fund it, whether that's miles driven instead of a gas tax. But there needs to be new revenue to fund the infrastructure that is over 50 years old now.
So are we going to get anything?
It depends on what happens in the midterms, because what we will get is something through May, but a long-term fix is not going to happen this Congress. But if the Republicans come back and they take control of the Senate, they will have a much greater chance to dictate exactly how they want to write a highway bill, and then the question will be whether they can keep their coalition together and get the White House on board.
All right, Manu, quickly, tell us what happened Tuesday in Georgia.
Oh, that was a very important runoff election involving one of the most important Senate races in the country. David Perdue, a Republican businessman who's former Dollar General CEO, former Reebok CEO. He barely won this race against Jack Kingston, 11-term congressman. And it was a big surprise in the political world because Kingston had the support from conservatives, from the establishment, from the Chamber of Commerce.
And why is his race so important?
Control of the Senate hangs on it. This was a Republican state. Democrats think with Michelle Nunn, they have a chance to flip it. She is the daughter of the former governor there. It's one of the few pickup opportunities Democrats have. It's going to be a tight race. And if Republicans can't hold that, it's going to be very difficult for them to take control of the Senate.
Chris Breitz, investigative correspondent for CNN. We'll take a short break here. Remember, you can see all of our guests live, streaming on video, drshow.org. Right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Secretary Kerry proposes a week-long truce between Israel and Hamas. Pro-Russian separatists shoot down two Ukrainian military jets. And Boko Haram is suspected in deadly Nigerian bombings. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. In this hour, we are video streaming live. So if you'd like to see our guests, go to drshow.org. And let's go first to Michael in Durham, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to discuss the issue of the Central American children, and it seems with the discussion among politicians and pundits and even people phoning in that nobody wants to recognize our responsibility to them, which is our support for dictatorships in the region in the 19th and 20th century, which led to extreme inequality, and the more recent history of the Reagan administration supporting death squads and dictatorships in the 1980s during the Civil Wars that led to a great deal of violence and social dislocation, which have led our regional neighbors to become failed states.
Well, I think the caller raises a great question. And I don't think that we are not looking out for our neighbors. I think when you look at, as Karen mentioned earlier in the show, what we did with Colombia to try to rebuild them, we give lots and lots of aid to Mexico. We've been trying to help build their economy for years. It's not easy, as we have seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, to necessarily, just because you give money and support, to see a nation, you know, pull itself up by its bootstraps. So even when you're helping, and certainly the caller raises a good point that we and our foreign policy has been mixed in terms of, you know, over the last few decades. But even in the most recent support we've given them, it's not necessarily a slam dunk that these countries are going to be able to become places where people want to stay.
And there's also the question that our country is a big market for their drug traffic.
Sure. Let's go to Bruce in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hello, Diane. You are a treasure. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you.
My comment is this. I hear the talking heads all the time speak about Congress doesn't act, won't act, and so on. I have one comment and one comment only. The only part of Congress that will not act is the Republican Party. I have never witnessed such outrageous irresponsibility in my 58 years.
What do you think?
Well, I think you could make the argument that the Democratic Senate has also not acted on a number of issues that are important to both the president and to Republicans. Having been up there, I could not agree with the caller that it's only Republicans who haven't acted.
At the same time, you have to go back historically to the early statements made by leading Republicans that we will do everything to make sure this president fails.
But look, the members of Congress who were elected by the Tea Party in particular in the 2010 election were sent here specifically to stop things, not to pass things. I mean, the safest vote in a lot of, and particularly in Republican politics, is often no. And guess what? A lot of people think that's a good thing.
But, you know, compromise is a problem, is a dirty word in Republican primary politics. And it's forced a lot of senators who, you know, have the, you know, who have long time, long reputations of cutting deals and being open to cutting deals to not really want to do that when they're in the middle of the heat of a primary campaign and where they're threatened to be primaried on the right. But even Democrats, too, as Chris was mentioning, I mean, in the Senate, you know, Harry Reid has really no desire to put controversial bills on the floor to force his guys who are in tough races to take tough votes. There's not much desire because he doesn't think the Republicans will compromise with him, but he's not necessarily trying very hard either because he doesn't want to put any of his guys at risk.
So gang, what does all this say about our democracy? Does it continue to work or not?
Well, I think Chuck Schumer got to this question earlier this week when he floated the idea of an open primary,
right,
and that maybe we can take some of the extremes out of these primaries by opening up to everybody and not just registered Democrats or registered Republicans.
We did a show on that yesterday, and the overwhelming conclusion was the better way to go is a single primary day. So
a jungle primary like California.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
We'll see. All right, let's go to Joanna in Kerrville, Texas. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want you to know that I think you're wonderful.
Thank you.
My comment is pretty simple. I just want to say it's about the children coming up from Mexico, that the governors whose hearts are so cold towards them should be ashamed of themselves. And they're taking a stance against them for purely political reasons, it seems like. And forgetting the fact that these are human beings who are suffering and coming to us as a country who was founded upon the principle of taking people in who had nowhere else to go. I used to be proud of us as a country for being a place that would do that, to take in the people sick and the wounded. But now I don't feel that that's really our true goal anymore. And I think we've gotten a long way from what we ought to be.
I'm paraphrasing the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, I mean, this is speaks to just how emotional of an issue this is. And the immigration issue is generally, you know, you have a division between folks who really feel concern and have a lot of compassion from folks who are coming into this country and want a better way of life. But then you have people who say that, you know, people, there is an immigration system for a reason, and people who want to come here should access that system legally. So that this is not an issue that has been resolved because of just how emotional it is.
All right. To George in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope that, just got two comments. One, I think there's a difference between saying both Republicans and Democrats aren't doing anything. I think if the Democrats ask the Republicans, let's work on a particular issue or a particular, let's do something, we know that Republicans will say no. The Republicans only ask the Democrats to agree with them. They don't ask to work with them. And my second comment, which I noticed, I guess about after the second or third year of Obama's being elected, was that it seemed to me that the Republicans want to cause disruption. They want to cause harm to this country because they know that there's a good chance that the Democrats and Obama will be blamed for it. It doesn't matter what the source is. He's president. He takes the blame.
Well, the Republicans wouldn't agree with the caller, but you know the argument from you hear similar arguments from the Senate Democratic leadership who say that the reason why the Republicans are sowing dysfunction is they want to pin it on the Senate. The reason why we don't want to cut a deal with Democrats is because then it'll look like Washington is working and that'll hurt our election hopes. But you know that I think that argument is a little too simplistic. There's certainly blame to be cast on both sides.
Well, and I think this ignores the fact that the basic Republican philosophy is that government is too big, that it does too much,
absolutely,
and people pay too much in taxes. So this is, I mean,
you've got an ideological split right.
It is
down every single issue we're dealing with.
Yes, it is an absolute ideological disagreement, and we're seeing that's what we see played out every day.
And that's why I'm asking, is our democracy at a turning point?
Well, I think so, and I think that when you – the other thing is that our government is run by people. And if you look at who's leading right now, you know, the president has never had the best relationship with Capitol Hill. When you talk to Democrats on Capitol Hill, they'll tell you that, and Republicans will tell you that. And there's not strong working relationships to help get things done. And you saw that during the fiscal cliff. I mean, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, went to talk to Barack Obama multiple times. It wasn't as if it was a my way or the highway, and they just couldn't get it together. Now, the White House likes to say, well, Boehner can't keep his soldiers in line, and he's a weak leader. But Republicans will say to you, well, neither can Harry Reid, and he can't put up many of his vulnerable Senate Democrats to take tough votes either.
Don't
so he's protecting them.
That John Boehner did reach agreement with the president and then went back to his own people, and it was undone.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, it shows how ungovernable the House is these days, in the days when there used to be pretty strong leaders. Nancy Pelosi was able to keep her people in line. Tom DeLay was a very strong leader in the House. This is a completely different Republican conference that does not take marching orders from their leadership. It makes it much harder for them to keep their folks in line.
And talk about another system that doesn't seem to be working. Two-hour period toward death, a botched execution in Arizona on Wednesday has now led to temporary halt in all executions there. I received an email this morning from Desiree. She's a veterinarian in Phoenix, Arizona. She says lethal injection is widely utilized in veterinary medicine as an accepted method for humane euthanasia. She says physicians are not trained and very few have any experience in performing humane euthanasia. she doesn't mention that doctors are prohibited from being present. Therefore, she goes on to say, it makes sense to me to use veterinary medicine as a model for lethal injections used to carry out the death penalty. If this has not been explored, why not?
Well, I don't know much about veterinary medicine, but I do know that part of the problem we're seeing now is that many of the drug companies that were making the cocktails for lethal injections started to come under scrutiny when anti-death penalty advocates realized who these companies were. They were starting to raise awareness. They were boycotting, and some of those companies, you know, stopped selling to states that were doing lethal injections. Some of those companies were European companies where it's illegal to do the death penalty. So now states have passed laws where they are shielding who is making these chemicals,
yeah.
And they are now going to different sources for the chemicals. They're being compounded differently, and we're starting to see the problems. This is the third case we've seen where there has been a botched execution. One was in Oklahoma, and the other one was in Ohio. So this is becoming a problem, and death arguments now are being made by folks who are on death row that they should be granted a stay because of these problems.
It's interesting. NPR's Morning Edition had a super piece this morning on the history of capital punishment, from hanging to the electric chair to lethal injection, and how there are always botched up executions. I find myself wondering whether this latest one is going to lead to a wholesale review of capital punishment. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Hedgeville, West Virginia. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I had a comment on this issue, that if we can cleanly, humanely euthanize Grandma in Oregon, but we can't kill brutal murderers humanely. There's something wrong. But my main comment had to do with our obligations in Central America, that one of your previous callers mentioned that we do have obligations. We went in there last century, sent in the Marines to protect Chiquita Banana, basically. So we do have an obligation in Central America. But our big obligation is to get rid of our demand. The people that use the drugs we need to crack down on that. Either decide to make it legal and license people to be able to use drugs, or keep it illegal. But I would recommend like a 10% of the gross worth fine for people that use these drugs, that fund these gangs that caused the problem in the first place.
So. All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Any comment, Manu?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the issue, too. How do you get in? You know, these countries are neighboring countries. These are places that we have a long history and involvement with. How, you know, you can't just turn a blind eye and send all these kids back. You have to deal with it in a humane way, particularly when folks raise a legitimate concern. Perhaps some of the things that the United States has done certainly has contributed to the crisis down in those regions.
To Kathy in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm okay.
I think hearing about so many of these children's stories, it is heartbreaking that they are driven for this dangerous journey to our country. But on the other hand, we have children hungry here. But why can't we set up refugee camps in their countries and have the UN involved and maybe start cracking down on the crime that drives them here?
You know, that
it would
that
be safer for them, you know.
Yeah, the caller raises a good point, and one that I think hasn't been talked about too much on Capitol Hill. And I think, you know, part of the problem here, Diane, is that this is what you get when you don't do full-scale immigration reform, is you have these hot spots that pop up, and then you have to deal with them in a piecemeal way instead of saying, well, let's create a much saner way to deal with these problems that are more systemic. And until Congress and the president can get their act together and talk about this, and in this case, it's House Republicans talking about, you know, some kind of immigration reform, you're going to continue to see these kinds of problems consume the nation for a while, go back underground, and then pop up again.
Yeah, but although the last time we did comprehensive immigration reform in 1986, when there was a very large amnesty, it was followed by a very large flood of more illegal immigrants. So, you know, that is the art. So what we've really seen in the large political sense from this is that a number of polls are now showing that public support for a path to legalization for the 11 million illegal immigrants who are in this country now has dropped significantly as we have watched this crisis on the border.
Yeah, that's been the concern from the Republicans, and say that if you do an immigration reform, it'll invite more people in. And that's why you've seen conservatives go after the president's 2012 deferred action program, helping young people who are brought to the country illegally. They say that that has given people false hope that they could get the same thing in the future.
Last word, Manu Raju of Politico, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Chris Freitz of CNN. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Athena Health.